Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today on our weekly roundtable, we discuss the implications and consequences of the arrest of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. He was taken out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London by British police, where he lived for the last 7 years. He is awaiting possible extradition to the United States, where he is being charged with conspiring to crack a code that would allow illegal access to a Pentagon computer. Some are expecting that more charges will be filed by the United States against Assange. Meanwhile, the UK Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has said that Assange should not be extradited. Also, what does the shift to the right of governments in Central and Latin America have to do with the arrest of Assange, in particular, the change of government in Ecuador? Also, we return to turmoil in the Middle East with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu winning re-election by forming a coalition with extreme right-wing forces. What will this mean for Palestinians, for Iran, and the entire region? What role did the Trump administration play in his re-election? Continued attacks with charges of anti-Semitism against Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and moves by the U.S. Congress to equate boycott, divestment, sanctions, a peaceful protest against Israeli policies toward Palestinians, with anti-Semitism. Why are some calling U.S. Attorney General Bob Barr Trump's mouthpiece and the most dangerous man in America? And what has happened to what we are taught are supposed to be checks and balances among the three branches of the U.S. federal government, legislative, executive, and judicial? Are they broken, or simply, are they just functioning as outlined in the U.S. Constitution? Why should any of us believe in the ability of the federal government to implement these checks and balances? Does all this call into question what democracy actually means in the United States today? Is it a reality? Our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. British Labour Party leaders are saying their government should oppose the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the U.S. on charges of conspiring to break into a Pentagon computer. Party leader Jeremy Corbyn said in a tweet the U.S. is trying to extradite Assange because he exposed evidence of atrocities in Iraq and Afghanistan. Labour Party domestic affairs leader Diane Abbott said the government should block the extradition on human rights grounds. She told the House of Commons the U.S. case against Assange is about the embarrassment of the things he's revealed about U.S. military and security services.
And we should recall what WikiLeaks actually disclosed. Who can forget the Pentagon video footage of a missile attack in 2007 in Iraq, which killed 18 civilians and two Reuters journalist. It is the monumental amount of leaks such as this that lifted the veil on US-led military operation in a variety of theatres. Julian Assange is not being pursued to protect US national security. He is being pursued because he has exposed wrongdoing by US administrations and their military forces.
President Trump yesterday attempted to distance himself from his repeated campaign trail statements that he loved WikiLeaks, which released a treasure trove of materials that embarrassed and damaged Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign.
I know nothing about WikiLeaks. It's not my thing. And I know there is something having to do with Julian Assange. I've been seeing what's happened with Assange, and that will be a determination, I would imagine, mostly by the Attorney General, who's doing an excellent job. So he'll be making a determination. I know nothing really about him. It's not my deal in life.
Protesters in Australia, which is Assange's native country, called for his release and urged Britain not to extradite him. The Australian Journalists Union said Assange was being pursued for acts of journalism and also supported calls for his release. The Sudanese protest movement has rejected the military's declaration that it has no ambitions to hold the reins of power for long after ousting President Omar al-Bashir, who ruled for 30 years. In an online statement, the movement depicted the army's assurances as deception and called for an immediate handover of power to a civilian transitional government. The statement came shortly after a press conference in Khartoum by the country's new military rulers. The Sudanese Professionals Association, which spearheaded 4 months of demonstrations against al-Bashir, denounced the military statements as a farce. It also vowed to resist by peaceful means all the extraordinary measures the military has imposed since yesterday's ouster of al-Bashir, including a nighttime curfew and state of emergency. A top Red Cross official said he's more concerned than he's ever been about the possible regional spread of the Ebola virus in Congo after a recent spike in cases. The World Health Organization is meeting later today about whether to declare the deadly Ebola outbreak in northeastern Congo an international health emergency. The epidemic has become the second deadliest Ebola outbreak on record. Congo's health ministry yesterday reported more than 1,200 confirmed and probable cases, including more than 750 deaths. The minister said there were 40 new cases over 2 days this week. He called that rate unprecedented in the outbreak. The Ebola outbreak is occurring close to the borders of Uganda and Rwanda, with South Sudan not far away. The Senate has confirmed Acting Interior Secretary David Bernhardt to lead the department on a permanent basis. The vote came over the protests of Democrats that the former oil and gas lobbyist used his federal position to benefit former industry clients. Senators voted 56 to 41 to approve Bernhardt's nomination to oversee more than 500 million acres of public lands and other resources, including national parks, monuments, and wildlife refuges. He succeeds Ryan Zinke, who resigned in January amid a series of ethics investigations. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called Bernhardt well qualified to oversee the country's public lands and resources.
David Bernhardt is no stranger to the department. He served twice before. In fact, this body has confirmed him twice before. Each time, his professionalism and dedication proved us right.
Bernhardt represented energy and agricultural interests until President Trump picked him in April of 2017 to be deputy secretary. Democrats and environmental groups accused him of using his federal post to shape regulations and legislation in favor of oil and gas interests and other former clients. The State Department has barred a founder of the Palestinian-led boycott and divestment movement against Israel from entering the U.S. in what Omar Barghouti called a politically motivated move. An American Civil Liberties Union official said the move looks like an ideological exclusion, which is a long discredited form of government censorship. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and it is our weekly roundtable. I'd like to welcome our panelists, Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program for the Center for International Policy. She's based in Mexico City, a regular contributor to Counterpunch, Fortune, America's Updater, Foreign Policy in Focus, and several Spanish language publications. Laura Carlson is also a television host and commentator on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration, and gender issues for various international news outlets. Laura, welcome.
Thanks, Margaret. Good to be back.
And Jackie Goldberg, who has served in the California State Assembly, also as a member of the Los Angeles City Council. Prior to that, she served on and was later president of the Los Angeles School Board. And Jackie is bravely, yet again, entering the political fray, running to be part of the yet again of the Los Angeles School Board, and is now in a runoff election, even though she overwhelmingly won a large percentage of the vote. Jackie Goldberg, tell us when that runoff is going to be happening.
Well, the runoff is May 14th, and yes, we did get 48% of the vote with 10 candidates. We were very pleased, but in California, if it's not 50%, you go to a runoff, and that's what we're doing.
Right. Okay. So our listeners in Southern California, look out again. And the date, tell us again the date of the runoff, Jackie.
May 14th, but absentee ballots will be out next week.
Okay. All righty. Thank you, Jackie Goldberg. And Dr. Gerald Horn, the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's written more than 30 books, including his three most recently published books, Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, and the Rise of Afro-Asian Solidarity, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean, and Storming the Heavens, African Americans and the Early Fight for the Right to Fly. And Dr. Horn, we had to postpone because of our schedule, not yours, your speaking to our listeners here in Southern California, but that is now rescheduled for mid-July, so our listeners should listen up for that. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
And working on anything new, Dr. Horn?
Oh,
any books
time.
Coming out? I know all the time. We can't keep up with you. So what's coming out now?
Well, just dropping this week, in fact, is White Supremacy Confronted, U.S. Imperialism and Anti-Communism versus the Liberation of Southern Africa from Rhodes to Mandela. And in a few weeks, there will be Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music.
Oh, my goodness. Just can't keep up with you, Dr. Horn. As I often say, you write faster than most of us can read. Okay, we're going to. That's for sure. It's just amazing. Okay, so we're going to start off with the Julian Assange and what is happening with that. It's all over the news. Julian Assange, a WikiLeaks founder. WikiLeaks describes itself as an international nonprofit organization that publishes secret information, news leaks, and classified media provided by anonymous sources. Its website was launched in 2006 in Iceland by the organization Sunshine Press. Julian Assange, an Australian internet activist, is its founder and director, and they've released massive amounts of documents, including on April 2010, they released the collateral murder footage from July 12th, 2007, a Baghdad airstrike by the U.S., in which Iraqi journalists and civilians were among those killed. We actually played that clip. It was quite revealing and important at the time. And there were other releases by WikiLeaks, including the Afghan War Diary, the Iraq War Logs, and many others. And of course, famously, releasing some documents that were said to be embarrassing, to say the least, to Hillary Clinton during the last presidential election. Now, Assange has been officially charged by the U.S. with conspiring to hack into a secret Pentagon computer in a criminal indictment unveiled soon after his arrest. Assange is accused of working with Chelsea Manning, a former U.S. Army intelligence analyst, to break into the Defense Department's network in 2010 to obtain classified documents. So he is charged with one count of conspiracy to commit computer intrusion, and he faces a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison if convicted. But many are predicting that the U.S. will pile on, additional charges to that. And last month, Chelsea Manning herself was sent to prison indefinitely after she refused to take part in a U.S. Department of Justice investigation into WikiLeaks. She informed judges that she would accept, quote unquote, whatever you bring upon me. Okay, so Chelsea Manning, I understand that she's now out of solitary confinement where they had placed her initially, but nevertheless, she is still in prison, and she previously served time in prison between 2010 and 2017 for her continued refusal to testify before a grand jury against Julian Assange. And Manning herself, she was charged with 22 offenses. Let us go to just a short clip now from NBC News having to do with why Ecuador, Julian Assange was holed up for the last 7 years in the Ecuadorian consulate in London, England, on why they ended asylum for Julian Assange.
This morning, Julian Assange is gearing up for a fight, waiting to find out if he'll be sent to the U.S. to face charges. On Thursday, the handcuffed Assange giving a thumbs up and winking at cameras as he entered a London courtroom. Despite a not guilty plea, a judge quickly convicted him of skipping bail, calling him a narcissist who cannot get beyond his own selfish interests. WikiLeaks founder shouting and struggling as he was dragged out of the Ecuadorian embassy in Britain, where he had holed up for 7 years, after that country revoked his asylum. Ecuador's president accusing Assange of discourteous and aggressive behavior, the move clearing the way for a U.S. extradition request. The Justice Department unsealing an indictment Thursday accusing Assange of conspiracy with former Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning to hack into a Pentagon computer. Assange's lawyers are vowing to fight.
It is unacceptable that a publisher be extradited to face prosecution in the United States for publishing truthful information, and no democratic government should be seeking to prosecute a publisher for that, and nor should any other democratic government extradite a publisher for doing that.
WikiLeaks released hundreds of thousands of classified documents on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2010, embarrassing the U.S. government. The group also behind the release of emails hacked from the Democratic National Committee in 2016.
The bottom line is he has to answer for what he has done, at least as it's been charged.
Then-candidate Trump praised WikiLeaks on the campaign trail.
WikiLeaks, I love WikiLeaks.
But now the president's saying,
I know nothing about WikiLeaks. It's not my thing.
Assange's supporters say he's a journalist and whistleblower, calling his arrest an attack on free speech.
Okay, there you heard Donald Trump with his usual double speak. He loves WikiLeaks, and then, well, he doesn't really know anything about WikiLeaks. Laura Carlson, starting with you, though, you know, the shift to the right of several governments south of the border played a role in this arrest and what has happened, because Julian Assange holed up in the Ecuadorian consulate in the UK and was given that asylum by Rafael Correa, who was more to the left. Now you have Ecuadorian President Lenin Moreno, who is more to the right and seems to be want to curry up to the United States. So tell us a little bit about that, what's happening in Ecuador, and the wider implications of what is seen by many as Ecuador kowtowing to the United States, even though they talk about being tired of, you know, Julian Assange being rude and discourteous, et cetera.
Yeah, I watched that full statement from Lenin Moreno, and it's outrageous. So what he's done, basically, this is another example of how geopolitics and pressure from the United States government trumps international law, or even national law in this case, because Julian Assange not only had asylum from the Ecuadorian government to remain in the embassy, but he had also been made a citizen of the country. So Lenin Moreno just reverted all that. We have to go back a little in the history here, too, because Moreno is actually the candidate of Rafael Correa and was elected to continue the legacy of the center-left Correa government in Ecuador. Once he got into office, he completely shifted his political ideology and policies, and has begun this campaign basically against everything that Correa stood for. So it has been a sharp shift to the right in Ecuador, and there's a history of pressure. Many people have said that Mike Pence offered loans and support to the Ecuadorian government that Mike Pompeo was down there several times to pressure the Ecuadorian government. And with this pressure and his own shift to the right, Moreno was took this grave decision, which seems to be in violation of international law on many fronts, to expel Julian Assange from the embassy and make it possible for the United States to get the British government to arrest him there. Now, this is a huge event in many ways. They've charged him with hacking because they wanted to avoid the criticisms, the very valid criticisms, that they were prosecuting him for publishing the material, for simply publishing the material, which, of course, would raise the hackles of people all over the world in defense of the First Amendment in the United States and of freedom of speech in general. However, they can't get around it that easily because it's clear that he's being punished for publishing this material. In fact, the Obama administration did an investigation and didn't find evidence that he cooperated with Chelsea Manning in actually obtaining the documents. So they've got a big case in front of them, too. Glenn Greenwald said that the criminalization of journalism by the Trump Justice Department and that every journalist should be raising their voices. Unfortunately, in the mainstream media in the United States anyway, we're not seeing that. We're still seeing a coverage that's very centered on a controversial figure, very personalized, ignoring the overall issues. The ever-smug New York Times even discounts him as a journalist. They said, though he's always described himself as a journalist, he's been far too much of an activist to be satisfied with the role of neutral and fair-minded provider of information like ostensibly we are, you know?
Yeah.
And that's an absolute sham, because this will have a chilling effect. They were the ones who published the material and benefited greatly from that access to that material, and it denies First Amendment rights. Excuse me. And then the other point is that they're doing this in Great Britain and pressuring the Ecuador government along the way. So we've got this huge overreach in which the idea that a government to deny First Amendment rights and freedom of expression can even go into another country and call for extradition on a very shaky claim like this is a huge red flag in terms of the situation. And the final point is the obvious one, that we really owe a debt of gratitude to both these people, to Julian Assange and to Chelsea Manning, incredibly brave every step of the way. Because what they did is they put a human face on the war that we're seeing, and that issue has been lost in all this coverage. They showed us what the callous killing of civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan actually looks like. And that discussion has been lost in all this, and we need to go back to that discussion, because to understand the real meaning of the kind of wars that the United States is carrying out across the world is fundamental to changing the foreign policy.
Thank you. And Jackie Goldberg just weighing in on this. There are some reports that there is some kind of leak that says the United States actually has email or other communication between Assange and Chelsea Manning. And it is on that basis that they have narrowed the charge to that, even though others believe that more charges are going to be piled on. The particular charge right now of the United States against Assange carries a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison if convicted, but we don't know if that's going to be the end of it. The other thing about it, just from the a point of view of women, I mean, we all remember the initial charges by women in Sweden of sexual abuse and sexual assault by Julian Assange. And our hearts always go out to any victim of rape and sexual assault out there, because we know what that triggers. Sweden has now dropped those charges. But there is, you know, Julian Assange, I mean, the judge yesterday called him a narcissist. Ecuador says that he was rude and ungrateful and refused to clean up after his cat and expected others to basically serve him. So there doesn't seem to be, if we're to believe all of that, any doubt that there's some questionable, I should say, characteristics, personal characteristics of Julian Assange. Setting those aside, or even keeping those in mind, though, your thoughts on what's happening to him now and what the broader implications are for all of us. Jackie Goldberg.
Well, actually, I'm interested in how this all affects Chelsea Manning.
Yep.
Because she's been in jail for a long time for refusing to tell a grand jury everything she knows about Assange. And I think that one of the things that should come from this indictment is that they don't need her testimony. They have, in all legal terms, everything that they need already, or they couldn't have filed the charges. So it would lead to one to perhaps conclude that the continued incarceration of Chelsea Manning is political and is punitive and has nothing to do with trying to get her to testify against somebody who, against whom they have so much evidence that they did this charge against him and released it and unsealed it. So my hope is that this gets Chelsea Manning some freedom finally, because she took a stand against the idea that the grand jury secrecy was punitive. And that what they wanted her to do was to attack Assange, and that they needed, what they kept her in jail for is they claimed they needed her testimony in order to know what really happened. Well, I think the indictment of Assange shows that that's an absolute lie, and it is time to insist that the government finally let her go. as to Assange himself, you know, I certainly believe that he's a journalist. There is, however, of course, continuing question as to whether or not he participated in getting the material from and giving it to the Russians during the campaign, which, of course, would not be a journalist's behavior, but would be a behavior of an advocate of something. So I think that he's a mixed bag, but I do think that if we see him prosecuted under this kind of Mickey Mouse arrest, because they don't want to take on the First Amendment issues, that it will have a continuing negative effect on people and publishing things that are controversial, lest they be considered illegal, and that further erodes the press being able to do its job, which is to inform us about all things that we need to know in a democracy.
And Jackie, we do hear the children playing around you. And as per usual, Jackie, you're always involved in education and working with young people, which is so important. But thank you for your comments here. And Dr. Gerald Horn, I mean, just weighing in on all of this, you know, the Washington Post is saying, well, you know, he's no journalist, right? Basically, he's just a criminal. And you have the very mainstream media that were very happy to publish documents from WikiLeaks now denying his journalism, even though what he and Chelsea Manning did, and I'm very glad that Jackie Goldberg underscored what's happening to Chelsea, because she's gone to prison. She's been paying a price. She's ready to say that she'll accept whatever you bring to me, quoting her. A lot of people are concerned that Chelsea wasn't protected in the way that Julian Assange has been protected. But just your thoughts on all of this, including now that the people who are turning against Assange, who perhaps formerly would have supported him because of what happened, the leak that happened during the 2016 presidential election that Trump really blew up and campaigned on and said he loved WikiLeaks for the embarrassing material that was released by WikiLeaks during the election, and some members of the Trump team allegedly coordinating with WikiLeaks. So we have to assume Julian Assange and all this. Dr. Horn.
Well, your critique and the critique of other panelists of the analyses of the Washington Post and the New York Times is a reflection of a larger rift in the anti-Trump forces. I'm speaking of this center-left rift. You see that with regard to certain Democrats saying that they can support any Democratic nominee for president except Bernie Sanders. You see that in the recent historic victory in the Chicago elections of five Democratic socialists elected to the Chicago City Council, an astonishing victory, but in turn has received criticism from other members of the Democratic Party. And you see this as well with regard to the coverage of Julian Assange, with regard to CNN, giving a stern critique of Mr. Assange, and of course, Pacifica on the left taking an opposing position. This centered left rift, I'm afraid to say, if it's not dealt with substantively, could easily lead directly to Mr. Trump's reelection in November 2020. I think also the Julian Assange case reflects issues with regard to what's happening in the UK itself. That is to say that because of Brexit, there is a possibility that Britain may have to call an election before October 31st when they're slated to exit altogether. If that takes place, there's a possibility that Labour will come to power, and Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott have already made clear that they're not in favor of an extradition of Julian Assange, an extradition process which may take years, by the way. Well, while on the other hand, if Theresa May or the Tories are somehow reelected or retain power, you can guarantee that Mr. Julian Assange will be put on the first jet to Washington, D.C. Similarly, I would also like to say that it raises historic questions as well. That is to say that recall Daniel Ellsberg during the Pentagon Papers controversy some decades ago. It would be as if those who supplied him with a copy machine could be prosecuted for assisting Daniel Ellsberg copying all of these documents revealing the dirty secrets of the war in Vietnam. I think that this Julian Assange case raises many, many, many questions, which is one of the reasons why it will be in the headlines for some years to come.
Right. Thank you, Dr. Horn. And just FYI to our listeners, apparently the USA Today is reporting that prosecutors in Sweden are considering reopening an investigation into the sexual assault allegations against Assange, and that Sweden's deputy chief prosecutor said in a statement that her office had received a request late Thursday, I wonder from whom, to resume a rape probe into Assange from lawyers representing the alleged victim. So it was the lawyers of the victim, and they're saying that the case was dropped in 2017 because Assange was basically living in the embassy and therefore hindered the investigation. So this is far from over, even on the sexual assault charges, in addition to the charges that the United States has in store. So this is to be continued. But we're going to pause now for our station break. And when we return, the crisis in the Middle East has just gotten a lot worse, some say. And also, what about the system of checks and balances in the United States federal government? And what does Attorney General William Barr, is he really part of challenging those checks and balances? So stay with us. We'll be right back. And that is James and Bobby Purify. I'm your puppet. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. You're a member of Facebook. You can like and friend us on Facebook. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And our handle on Twitter and Instagram @SoTrueRadio. And we're also on SoundCloud. You can just find us there where all of our shows are archived. By the way, you could search by topic to get your favorite topic or your favorite roundtable discussion. We'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Florida, in the United States, in Florida, and internationally, a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in London, England, and indeed throughout the UK. It is our weekly roundtable, and our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. We're now going to turn our attention to the reality of the re-election of Benjamin Netanyahu, friend of Donald Trump. And he officially won his fifth term after he defeated Benny Gantz, who was his main election rival. And of course, Donald Trump is very happy. A lot of people are wondering what this all might mean for Palestinian people, but also just for the balance of power in the Middle East. And he won his fifth term with the help from far-right parties that are openly racist towards Arab people and have espoused Islamophobic views. And of course, in the lead up to the election, Donald Trump gave many gifts since Trump came into office to the Netanyahu government. But let us first go to a clip from Al Jazeera about Netanyahu's victory and what it might mean for Palestinians.
What President Trump thinks of as a peace is a peace between him and Prime Minister Netanyahu. They reckon that if America and Israel can arrive at a formula of sort, then that will be the formula to be imposed on the Palestinians and the Arabs. It's not only the Palestinians that are in the dark. The Arabs are also in the dark on what exactly are the Americans thinking about. And so in so many ways, now that Trump and Netanyahu agreed, the American president thinks this is a victory for the United States and for peace, because this is a victory for their peace proposal. In so many ways, this is not so much a peace with the Palestinians. This is a peace despite the Palestinians.
Annexing the West Bank, was that electioneering or something much more potentially significant and dangerous?
I mean, look, amazingly, yesterday only, in the Senate, Secretary Pompeo was asked, do you or do you not agree, do you or do you not support, do you or do you not object to Israel's annexation of parts of the West Bank? He would not answer. He wouldn't answer. He wouldn't answer if the acquisition of territory by force by Israel in the West Bank is okay or not. But what we do know is that the United States has already, on record, through American proclamation, supported the Israeli annexation of the Syrian Golan Heights. They already also agreed to Israeli basic de facto annexation of East Jerusalem. So on the record, this is already an open story that is seen by everyone.
All right, there you go. And that is a report from Al Jazeera. Laura Carlson, I mean, this business about hinting at annexing the West Bank, and this after the Trump administration went along with saying that the Golan Heights is really territory. This is against international law. And one has to wonder if Israel now, the Israeli government, is functioning in a way that almost implementing a Monroe Doctrine type approach to the Middle East. The Monroe Doctrine, of course, used by the United States for doing whatever it pleased south of the border, controlling governments, territory, et cetera. Laura Carlson, your view on the wider implications of all this?
Yeah, I think it's definitely been emboldened by both the Trump administration and by Netanyahu getting an historic fifth term. He still has to pull together a coalition, and he's still facing indictment on corruption charges. I mean, there's one scenario, not likely, that if that goes through, the coalition could fall apart at some point as well. But right now, we're clearly facing an additional threat to Palestinians, helped along by the support of Donald Trump, the pre-electoral gift of calling, of supporting the annexation of Golan Heights. And when we look at that, if he's willing to support that against all international law, then annexing the West Bank is clearly on the table. Also because Netanyahu won with the support of settler leaders and the extreme right groups that you mentioned, Margaret, that also have ties to neo-fascist groups. So we're seeing a move to the right. We're seeing a move that really basically, people say that it endangers the peace process. And I think that really, if you look at this and some of the statements that Netanyahu was making, saying, I'm going to make Israel a world force, not through concessions, but the exact opposite, we can fairly clearly say at this point that there is no peace process.
Right. And Jackie Goldberg, there's a lot of worry about this. And you have people in the Trump administration, running around saying, they want to support Israel. Right. But one has to wonder if what the Trump administration has done and what Netanyahu has done. Israel passing that nation state law in July of 2018, many people say that that's apartheid. It just legalizes Palestinians, Arabs living in Israel under a kind of apartheid. And then Trump recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the State Department freezing $65 million in aid for Palestinian people, the U.S. Trump moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the U.S. withdrawing from the Human Rights Council, the Trump administration closing the PLO office. One has to wonder if, at the end of the day, this is really in the best interest of the people who are living in Israel. Jackie Goldberg, your thoughts on the wider implications of all this? I think we might have lost Jackie. Jackie,
no, you didn't lose me.
Okay,
sorry.
All right.
Well, one of the things that was clear in the election was that the center left attacked Netanyahu, but it did not have a clear alternate vision of how to move to a peace process, and it wasn't particularly clear that the opponent, Gantz, was in favor of a two-state solution either. That's really part of the story here, because when that happens, then Netanyahu has a firm position and can offer it to the people to say, here's how we make Israel safe and secure. And, of course, security has always been one of the first issues for Israel. However, here comes the real question. What really happens to Israel's security if the Palestinian people know that permanently Israel has no intention of being anything other than an occupying force, never having any intention to get to a peace process, never choosing to decide that there should be a two-state solution of any type anywhere at any time? What really happens to Israel's security under that scenario? Well, first of all, Netanyahu had been successful in reaching out to some Arab leaders and getting recognition for Israel, or at least support for Israel's right to exist as a part of this whole Iran and Saudi and all of that other Middle East politics. Well, of course, now saying that they're going to annex Palestinian territory undoes that. What that means is new attacks on Israel, new support for the Palestinians to use a military to try to overcome this. With it has no military. And so this means that the slaughter will continue. It means that more and more people will die. It means that the opportunity to talk about a solution that will finally put to rest this kind of fight to the death that's going on is over. When that ends, we have no idea, and Israel really has no idea of what that could unleash in the way of militaristic and violent opposition to Israel. The only thing that keeps most of the Palestinians from getting into another intifada or anything else is the hope that the Trump administration kept saying over and over again, we're going to do it, we're going to be the ones, we are the ones finally to do peace. Well, that has been clearly a lie from the very beginning. And if his son-in-law has a plan, boy, it's too late now, because what we have done now is empowered the nationalist right wing to say that here is what the United States is going to support, and we can do any damn thing we want. Well, as long as that's the Israeli position, And the center-left did not really attack that position. What they went after Netanyahu on was on corruption, was on the fact that there are still a lot of problems in Israel around traffic. There's still a lot of problems in Israel around about the ability of people to get work that's meaningful, and that there are still security issues. They didn't attack any of that. And I think that's what gave Netanyahu the opportunity to slide slightly into the winning process. I believe this is an extraordinarily dangerous campaign win and an extraordinarily dangerous situation for anyone who seeks to see that Israel has is going to exist into the future, because it puts Israel's future completely at risk, I believe.
Yeah, and Dr. Gerald Horn, I mean, putting that within the context of the moves against Iran by both the Netanyahu government and, of course, the Trump administration, but also given the role that Israel has played as kind of like a military watchdog in a way for the U.S. in the whole region, not only the Middle East, I think also if you could segue a bit into what's happening in North Africa right now in relation to the Sudan and Algeria. Dr. Gerald Horn.
Well, first of all, with regard to the Israeli elections, I was struck by the fact that many commentators have drawn a parallel between Israel 2019 and possibly the United States in 2020 in terms of how the Likud and Netanyahu manipulated racism to produce this winning result, and how Mr. Trump will be doing so in 2020, particularly with his focus on the border with Mexico. Secondly, you are correct to point to rising tensions with Iran, not only in terms of designating Iran's Revolutionary Guard as a so-called terrorist group, an extraordinary maneuver, but also Mr. Trump backing the Israeli annexation of the Golan Heights, which complicates relations with Syria, the rightful owner of the Golan Heights, and also Syria is a key ally of Iran. It's very striking that Mr. Trump was elected in part because he made a critique of the U.S. military disasters in Iraq and Afghanistan, but yet he seems to be barreling full speed ahead to a conflict with Iran. Keep in mind that Mr. Obama was elected in 2008 because of his critique of Iraq and Afghanistan, and then he gave us the disaster in Libya, which, by the way, is experiencing a bloodbath as we speak. It has experienced chaos and disaster since the ill-advised overthrow of Gaddafi in 2011. Mr. Obama says that his chief error as a president was failing to prepare for the day after the overthrow of Mr. Gaddafi. One might say that the overthrow itself was a disaster. And, of course, you mentioned Algeria, where a leader of two decades, Bouteflika, was just forced out of office. Sudan, a leader of 30 years, was just forced out of office. Speaking of al-Bashir, the question is, will the new government expel him towards the International Criminal Court? Somehow, I doubt it. But in any case, back to Israel, it seems that this Israeli election is also leading to further tensions once again in the body politic in the United States of America. Recall that at the Israeli lobby meeting in Washington just a few weeks ago, all of the key Democratic nominees for president found something better to do than address AIPAC. Keep in mind as well that Beto O'Rourke, who is seen as a leading contender for president, has extraordinarily criticized the Israeli leadership as racist. This helps to underscore the fact that once again, Israel is causing major rifts in the U.S. body politic. And I would mention finally an article that appeared in the New York Times Magazine just a few weeks ago on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which pointed out that Congresswoman Omar, who has become a punching bag for many pro-Israeli forces, that there is a Congresswoman McCallum who has a district adjacent to Congresswoman Omar and has said many of the same things about Israel, but somehow she's not in the headlines. Of course, one of the differences is that Congresswoman Omar is of African descent and Congresswoman McCallum is not, which leads, it seems to me, to the inference that what's happening with regard to the attacks on Congresswoman Omar is just another expression of old-fashioned racism.
Yes, and her being Muslim added on top of that, and the moves by Congress now to basically criminalize the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, which is a peaceful approach to protesting Israeli policies against Palestinians. But quickly moving on now for the final part of our discussion, looking at who is William Barr, I mean, he's Trump's guy, the new U.S. Attorney General, and there's increasing worry about him. Of course, a lot of people were worried before he was confirmed. Some are now calling him the most powerful, most powerful threat to the United States, and just the most dangerous man in America, that's it, and also being Trump's mouthpiece. But I want to, before getting into the discussion, I just want to play a clip to give our listeners a sense of the background of this man.
Attorney General William Barr's performance this week isn't the first time he's aligned himself with the president he's serving.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Go back nearly 30 years to Barr's first stint as Attorney General under President George H.W. Bush. New York Times columnist William Safire, a conservative Republican, often referred to Barr then not as Attorney General, but as the cover-up general, suggesting he covered up Bush's role in Iraqgate, burying the investigation of how the Bush administration allegedly helped finance Saddam Hussein's weapons. Barr also played a role in the Iran-Contra affair, convincing President Bush just before Christmas in 1992 to pardon six former members of the Reagan administration, including former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, who was set to go to trial for allegedly lying to Congress. The pardons, at Barr's urging, essentially shut down the independent counsel's investigation, leading some to call it a miscarriage of justice. In 2001, Barr was asked about the pardons. His response, "The Iran-Contra ones, I certainly did not oppose any of them." Also telling in Barr's history is this 19-page unsolicited memo Barr wrote to the Justice Department in June last year, before Trump nominated him. In it, Barr criticizes the Mueller investigation, calling Mueller's obstruction of justice theory fatally misconceived.
It is what he was hired to do, which was to protect the president, but it is deeply concerning.
Back in 2017, Barr also raised eyebrows, telling the New York Times there was more basis for investigating the sale of uranium between the U.S. and Russia while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State than the Trump campaign's alleged collusion with Russia. But when Barr said it, the FBI had already investigated the Uranium One deal, and no evidence has ever been made public showing proof of a bribery scheme or wrongdoing. Barr later walked back his claims.
I have no knowledge of the Uranium One. I didn't particularly think that was necessarily something that should be pursued aggressively.
Meanwhile, if you think William Barr may be too close to the president, consider this. His son-in-law works in the White House counsel's office. The son-in-law's role is troubling, says the former director of the Office of Government Ethics, because, quote, it raises further questions about Barr's independence. Randy Kay, CNN, New York.
So Laura Carlson and our other panelists, given the time we have left, if you could single out one particular thing that worries you about, I know there's a lot, worries you about Barr and what he's doing. I'm wondering what that should be. And also looking at it within the context of this alleged separation of powers, which, as it turns out, the Constitution is kind of vague on it. So it's a little bit messy. And Trump is taking full advantage of it because the buck stops with him, as he puts it. Laura.
I think clearly the most disturbing thing about Barr and what we're seeing now in the Trump administration is this move toward authoritarianism. There's the question of Barr's independence isn't a question. He is not independent, and he was hired specifically not to be independent.
Yeah.
He's a gatekeeper. He's a mouthpiece. He has this history. And we've seen that this move toward authoritarianism is a move away from the rule of law. In the country that has supposedly been set up to be the example of rule of law throughout the world and has actually invaded in the name of the rule of law throughout the world. We know that there's a lot of hypocrisy historically in that claim, but what we're seeing now in terms of the blatant disregard for the law, because not only has Trump resuscitated William Barr, who's always played this role, as we could see from the clip that was played there, Margaret, is he's also resuscitated Elliot Abrams from the Iran-Contra, you know, John Bolton, a whole series of figures that we thought in the foreign policy community had been thoroughly debunked in terms
right.
of their respect for the law. So that would be, I think, the major concern. And the checks and balances with the stacking of the courts and everything that's happened is highly questionable at this point. Although, when you look at it, there have been a number of court rulings, especially on immigration, on the Muslim ban, on other Trump setbacks. The most recently is the injunction against the Remain in Mexico program of sending asylum seekers back to Mexico that have gone against Trump. So we still have the possibility of affirming the law through at least some
okay.
of the courts.
All righty, Laura, moving quickly, Jackie, I wanted to have Jackie and Dr. Gerald Horn weigh in on this. Jackie Goldberg.
Yes, I would agree entirely. I think, though, that holding the Mueller report and for weeks and weeks and giving the president the opportunity to run around the country and say, see, nothing here, nothing there, nothing to look at. It didn't really happen. It was all just a fake news. I think that's empowered the president to feel that even when this report comes out and we really find out what damaging stuff there was about him and his entire operation during the campaign and afterwards, that it will be too late because the narrative will have been set. And I think that's the whole point of it. And I think that's a part and parcel of undermining the notion of checks and balances. Checks and balances were designed by people who didn't want another king. And that's what we've got. We've got another king. And we've got another king in which the Republicans have decided to absent themselves from any constitutional
okay.
oversight of this president.
Right. And Dr. Gerald Horn, I mean, James Madison warned of the very definition of tyranny, all power in one set of hands. George Washington spoke of the necessity of reciprocal checks and balances in the exercise of political power. Just a quick comment on what this means for this alleged democracy, what's happened. Dr. Horn.
Well, obviously it spells ill, but I would just point to the fact that Mr. Barr accused the previous administration of spying on the Trump election
right.
team, which
yep.
opens the door for an investigation and possibly a prosecution of the previous administration officials, up to and including the previous president, which then opens the door for going after the rest of us.
Right. On that note, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We could have spent a lot more time on this. Another fascinating roundtable. I'd like to thank all of our panelists as well. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our board op, Lizette Tapia, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. If you like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. I hope you get to do something really nice this weekend. Butterflies all having fun. You know what?